Hello and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and today we are continuing our study in the book of Genesis. Today, touching on Genesis chapter 38. But to give you a reminder, kind of a recap of where we've been so far, because today's story kind of seems out of place, right? It kind of is a odd event. That's going to take place. It's definitely one of the more graphic stories, I would say, in the Bible. But there's going to be some important principles that we learn with that, not only application for our own lives, but also about some very important principles of what we need to be teaching and talking about much more as God's people, especially in this day and time. But last week, you remember, of course, we went over the very familiar story of Joseph, right? You know, that he was the favorite son, his coat of many colors. He goes out to check on his brothers at the orders of his father. He's told his brothers and his father, and even potentially Mother Rachel at that time, meaning that this may have actually happened. The chapter 37 may have begun a little bit before the death of Rachel and with the birth of Benjamin, of course. And so we see all of these things come together, a family that just absolutely hates their younger brother because of these visions that he's having, his father's special treatment. We're living in a family that, of course, was destroyed by sexual sins, by lying and deceiving. Just there's a whole lot of garbage, for lack of a better way of putting it, that has gone on in the family of Jacob that all comes to a head in chapter 37, of course, with the selling of Joseph into slavery. And then all of a sudden, the Bible kind of backtracks from the story of Joseph. Like, as soon as we get to chapter 39, we pick up right where we left off with Joseph. He's, you know, in Egypt, going to be sold as a slave. Okay? And we are told this very, very peculiar story about Judah. Now, we know that Judah is, of course, going to be the son who carries on the messianic line, right? That Christ would come as the Lion of Judah, meaning that this particular son is going to play a very important role in the line of the Messiah. However, that is not to say that this son is not without his own extraordinarily major flaws. Of course, one of those being that he wanted to kill Joseph. He was one of the ones that was ringleading the attack, the murder plot, basically, on Joseph. And what's going to happen today, I'm going to warn you ahead of time. And I've even done this with the church that I pastor. I teach and preach the Bible exactly as the Bible presents it. Sometimes that means we're going to touch on uncomfortable topics. Today is one of those. This is a very sexually explicit story. So if you're not going to be able to be a big boy or a big girl about this story, now is the time for you to get off of this recording, because we're going to divulge exactly what happens here, and we're going to be very honest about what occurs here. And the reason for that is that we have to be to understand the cultural implications of this chapter, because what's about to happen in this chapter is extraordinarily strange for our culture. And the reason for that is that since this story is going to deal very explicitly with sexual things, that leads us to having to talk about our own culture. So here in the United States, before we ever even jump into this, we're just going to get this two cultural divide thing laid out. Here in the United States, sex is very much a celebrated, sensualized, very immoral, very graphic topic. And there's a multitude of reasons for that. Number one, if we go back goodness, maybe 200, 300 years ago, maybe even further than that, we reached a point in time where God's people stopped educating God's people about the purpose, the nature, and the reason for sex and how that is supposed to work. We kind of got this idea that if we just taught sex is wrong, it's horrible, it's awful, and it's going to lead you into damnation, da 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 da, don't do it, that everybody would just buy that. Now, here's the problem with that, is that anybody who is married knows that there is pleasure in a sexual relationship. And so for you to basically just yell at everybody that it's this horrible, awful, terrible thing, we kind of started to put a stigma on the very act itself, which was extraordinarily wrong because we know that it is the blessing of the relationship between a husband and a wife. It's not something that was supposed to be stigmatized. It was something that was supposed to be understood. And instead of trying to teach people, probably more importantly, younger people, teenagers, things of this nature, what the role and purpose of sex is and how that plays in the life of a child of God, and what God's reasoning is for that particular activity, is what I'll just say. Instead of teaching that and teaching people to appreciate and love that, we turned it into a stigma. And here's the thing that happens, friends, when you turn things into a stigma, especially things that are not that, you make people want to go do it more. If I tell my wife, no, you can't have a cookie, and I put the cookie jar on the counter, the more I tell my wife, no, you can't have a cookie, the more my wife is going to be tempted to try and get a cookie. Is there anything inherently wrong with a cookie? No, there's nothing wrong with a cookie, as long as it is eaten, partaken of, in the proper context. And it's the same as with this idea of sex. And so, because we did that, now we've had this massive pushback where it's no, you can do whatever you want to do, and now you are actually seeing sex becoming being turned into a horrible and awful, immoral thing in various fashions. It's televised in various fashions. It's publicated in various fashions. There's all kinds of just garbage that now surrounds what was a beautiful and important part of a marriage. And that has a lot to do with God's people. There's no way we can ignore that. We, oh, no, Brother Zach, wait. No, we're the ones who said not to do it. Yes, we just said no, everybody everywhere, it's a horrible, terrible thing, you can't do it, to the point that there were married couples that slept in separate beds to try to make us all believe they were not doing that. That is not at all how the Bible displays this act. Now, switching to the other side of this, that's our cultural view. The reason this is going to be hard for us to grasp is because we stigmatized it, and now it is a free-for-all. There's no lines or morality involved at all. That's the world you're growing up in now. Some of you may be from the time that I was, where it is stigmatized, and now some of you may be younger, and you're coming up in the time where if you haven't committed that act with somebody by the time you're 12, 13 years old, you're an anomaly. All right? So that's our culture. Sex is a pleasure weapon, a pleasure tool. It's a weapon. It's a way to manipulate or control. It's a way to achieve what we want. For the Hebrews, sex played a very opposite role. Not saying that there weren't people that took advantage of the idea and concept our culture has. We're going to see that in this story. But the idea of sex for the Hebrew people, the number one accomplishment that they wanted out of that was not even necessarily the experience itself, but rather the result of, which are children. So that's going to lead us into a very interesting law that's going to come into practice here in regards to having children and the culture's view of the purpose of a woman's duties, goals, job, whatever, and the importance of children in their everyday life. So, Again, at this point, I am warning you, this is a very explicit story. If you are not going to be a big girl or a big boy about it, now is the time to get off of the podcast. Here we go, chapter 38. It says, "And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he took her and went in unto her. And she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name I've heard some say Er, all right, whichever you want to say. And she conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived and bare a son, and called his name Shelah. And here was at Shezib when she bare him." All right, so what happens here is Judah leaves his family, and he does exactly what he's not supposed to do. He takes a wife who is a Canaanite. The whole beginning book of Genesis, I told my wife the other day when we were talking about these podcasts, was that I feel like the whole point of the book of Genesis is to show you every way a family can become dysfunctional. All right, we have these people that they know better. They know what they're supposed to do, and they decide to not do it anyway, and it leads to these horrible atrocities that end up happening in these families. Many people will sit back and go, "I just can't believe that happened in so and so's family." And I'm like, "Well, did so and so lead their family behave as they, well, I mean, you know, they made a mistake here, a mistake there." And I'm like, "Well, those mistakes go on beyond us." It's why it's extraordinarily important, especially with raising your children, that you instill the live as I live, not do as I say mentality as a lot of people try to do today. Why? Because your kids are going to imitate your life regardless of what doctrine you preach at them. They're going to do what they have seen their mother and father do, and that's what Judah does. He has seen his father neglect and go against what God has said many, many times, especially when dealing with a matter of wives and sexual behavior. And so he just takes the wife that he wants. And this particular wife gives him three sons. Okay? It says, "And she had again conceived and bare a son, called his name Shelah." I've heard some say Shelah, Shelah, whatever you want to say. It doesn't matter. Just you say it however you want to. All right? It says, "And Judah took a wife for whichever you want, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar." I've heard some say Tamar. I don't know how you say that, but Tamar. If you want to say that one, you can say that one. Doesn't matter. What we know here is that now we had a point where the oldest son is now old enough to be married, and Judah gets him this wife, Tamar. And Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. So right off the bat, we have Judah, who has been raised in this horrible, awful household, has seen his father go against God, go against God, go against God, do what he wants to do, do what he wants to do, lie, manipulate, da 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 da. You guys all know this because we've been talking about it for a long time now. Judah, of course, sees his father do all this, decides he's going to do the same thing. He finds him a wife for the Canaanites he thinks is a good-looking lady. He marries her. She has three children. Firstborn son, he gets married. The man is so evil. All right, before he ever can have children, the man is so evil, God himself kills him. Now, we have no idea what he did to make God that angry. Obviously, it would have had to have been extraordinarily bad, since the sons of Jacob have committed mass genocide and all kinds of other things. Since we have been in the book of Genesis. However, whatever this man did, he had to have been a specially, specially evil individual for God himself to have taken the time to kill him. So here we have the beginning of a situation, all right? And they're about to paint this picture for you in just a second, but I want to set it up because of what we talked about earlier with looking how culturally we view sex, okay? Because that's going to come into play here in just a moment. So what we have here is we have Tamar, who is married to Judah's oldest son, all right? And is so horribly evil, bad, God kills him before they ever have children. Now, in this day and time, for a woman to be a widow in itself was almost a death sentence. Okay? It was the worst thing that could happen. The reason for that is because whether you agree with it, like it, don't like it, whatever, women were essentially helpless without a husband or without children, okay? And basically they had two options. They could live destitute and die, or they could become a prostitute. That was basically the what would happen if they did not have family, especially family of their own, children or a husband. Now, in Tamar's case, she's in a much better position because in this society, in this day, culture, time, whatever you want to call it, there was a practice where the next son or the brother, the next eldest brother of this particular individual who had died, would go in and have a physical relationship, marry his brother's wife, have a physical relationship only for the purpose of providing an heir for his brother so that not only his name could be carried on, but his wife would not live destitute. Okay? This is where things get different because we go, this is really weird. Because when we talk about sexual relationships in any way, shape, or form in our culture, it is about pleasure only. And that is the way we are programmed. Even in the husband and wife relationship, many believers look at that act as more of a we get to have fun than we're trying to have children. Many, many times today, whether that's because of, finances or concerns or just pure selfishness, whatever, we don't really want children to come out of that act, even though the purpose of that act is to make children. Now, I'm not on here saying it, I'm not on here at all saying that you need to just footloose and fancy free and have all of the children you can possibly have. No, that would be a foolish idea. You don't have any more children than you can take care of or that you are going to properly take care of, okay? But you have to understand that in this day and time, that was not what sex was all about. The purpose was to have as many children as you could. That was an honor thing, okay? It was a big deal. And so to raise up an heir, the brother would come and basically provide an heir for the wife, okay? And what's going to happen here is that Onan, his brother, is going to be asked to do this. It says, "And Judah said unto Onan, Go in unto thy brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed to thy brother." All right, so Judah is doing what is right according to God's law. Even though God's law has not been written yet, it will be written much, much later. This was a practice that God used to protect the not only women and the bloodlines of their deceased husbands, but also it was a picture of what Jesus Christ would do for us. Meaning, not meaning, that physical act, but meaning that Jesus would step in and help us in our time of trouble. That's kind of what the idea, the picture is. Now, here's a problem. Sometimes people would try to take advantage of this system with the cultural view that we have, which is that they wanted to have the pleasure, but they did not want to have the child. Okay? And so Onan is asked to do this. It says, "And Onan knew that the seed should not be his. And it came to pass when he went in unto his brother's wife that he spilled it on the ground, lest he should give seed to his brother. Onan realized that he would be responsible for this woman and her child. And there was nothing for him to benefit out of this. Okay, what would happen is that this son would be raised as his brother's son. And this son would get all of his brother's stuff. And eventually he would kind of lose, for lack of a better way of putting it, his rights to Tamar. Okay, meaning that this wasn't a relationship where he got to have a second wife. The whole basis of this relationship was a heir was raised for his brother, and then at that point, he was done. He had nothing. There was no skin in this fight. He didn't get any money. He didn't get any land. He didn't get the woman. He didn't get nothing. And so Onan knows this. Now, Onan thinks he's going to be smart and say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so he goes in, he performs the act, and then at the last second when he would, give her a child, he pulls. All right, and I'm going to leave it at that because you're all big kids and you can kind of figure this out for yourselves. All right, and finishes elsewhere. Okay. Now, a lot of people read this story and they use it for all kinds of doctrines and beliefs. This story is not about sexual immorality at in the way that many of you are going to assume. I've heard people talk about onanism with this, which is a fancy way to say the topic of masturbation. That's not at all what happened here. That's not even remotely close to what happened here. Some people use this as try to say that birth control is not biblical. That has nothing to do with what happens here. What happens here is that Onan takes advantage of this woman and he essentially rapes her. A lot of people do not understand that by the cultural reason, the only reason this act is occurring is to raise a child for Tamar's deceased husband, aka the brother of Onan. The only way that she consented to this was with the idea that there would be a child that would come in honor of, in memory of her husband, and to provide for her. Him not finishing his end of the deal is not only him taking advantage or trying to manipulate, use the law of God for his own personal selfishness, but also he is essentially now raped this woman. And what happens is that he does this, and it says, and the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. Onan does not get away with it. Onan rapes his sister-in-law, basically, does not provide an heir, does not fulfill his obligations as the brother of her deceased husband. And because he tried to take advantage of this law to get what he wanted, God killed him for it. Now, this brings us to a very peculiar situation, all right? Already, this story is very, very weird by our standards, okay? And by our thought processes and our day-to-day. This story is already way out in left field. And it's going to get a lot worse here in just a moment. But what we've had happen so far is Judah, this is obeys the law of God, marries a woman he ought not to marry, and of course he's done a whole lot of other things before now, before now at this moment, that have shown him to not be the best individual. This leads to him having three children, one of whom is so evil that before he can even conceive children, God kills him. His second son is so evil that he manipulates his dead brother's wife, rapes her under a law that would have provided for her under what would have been a biblical kindness, and he is now killed by God. That leaves Mr. Judah with only one heir himself, which is his son, Shelah. Okay? And you put yourself in Judah's shoes, all right? Two of your sons are now dead, both slain by God himself, okay? And Judah, instead of admitting this is because of my own sins and the lack of ability to raise my children, he instead goes, well, the common denominator here is Tamar. So I am just not going to fulfill my job as father-in-law and as patriarch of this family, and we're not going to give her any more sons, and I'm just going to kind of let her live in her father's house, and we're going to forget about her. Okay? And so that's what Judah tries to do. It says, and the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. Then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at thy father's house, till Shelah, my son, be grown. For he said, lest peradventure he die also, as his brethren did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up into his sheep shears to Timnath, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Timnath to shear his sheep. And she put her widow's garments off of her, and covered her with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given unto him to wife. All right, so Judah goes, you know, you just go stay at your father's. Again, gonna do what he wants to do. He's gonna disobey the law of God. He's going to put himself in a horrible predicament because he hasn't learned to, like his father hadn't learned, to just do what is right. And what ends up happening is she goes to her father's house. She's living there, and in the time that she's living there, Judah's wife dies. And basically, he is now a single man. He's alone. And he's going to go up to Timnath with his buddy Hira to do some business stuff, make sure his sheep are sheared and sold, all this good stuff. And as he's going up there, someone comes to Tamar, who has seen that Shelah has grown and is old enough to fulfill this obligation, and she has not been given to him to fulfill this obligation. Now, a lot of people read this and go, well, why didn't she just go marry somebody else? She could not. By the law of this day and time, she was under the welfare of Judah. Meaning that if he did not give her to wife, she could never marry again. And so they come and tell her, look, your father-in-law is headed up to Timnath, you know, kind of hinting at what she should do. And so Tamar takes this into her own hands. One of the biggest things you're going to see in this story is that sin breeds sin, that breeds sin, that breeds sin. Okay, until somebody decides to do the right thing, despite what they want to do, sin just continues to progress unhinged. And so she decides, if he's not going to give me Shelah, I'm going to get my heir one way or another. Like I said, Judah's wife is dead. There's something that Mr. Judah is now not getting to actively participate in, which is the act of sexual intercourse. And so she goes up and pretends to be a harlot on the road. And when she gets up there on the road, she lays everything out like she is a harlot, and Judah comes by. And so it says here that when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. And he turned unto her by the way, and she said, go to, I pray thee, let me come in unto thee. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what wilt thou give me, that thou mayest come in unto me? And he said, I will send thee a kid from the flock. And she said, wilt thou give me a pledge till thou send it? And he said, what pledge shall I give thee? And she said, thy signet, and thy bracelets, and thy staff that is in thine hand. And he gave it her, and came in unto her, and she conceived by him, And she arose and went away and laid, excuse me, and conceived by him. And she arose and went away and laid by her veil from her and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judas sent the kid by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he found her not. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where is the harlot that was openly by the wayside?" And they said, "There was no harlot in this place." And he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." And also the men of the place said that there was no harlot in this place. Then Judah said, "Let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I sent this kid, and thou hast not found her." All right. So what happens is that Tamar finds out about this. She clearly knows something about her father-in-law that a lot of other people haven't figured out, and that is that he is very interested in the benefits of the marriage relationship, and with his wife dead, he's not getting to partake in that anymore. And so she goes and lays by the way, and as she is, Judah comes by, he sees her over there. And Judah comes from a wealthy family, I'm sure was a decently wealthy man himself, and decides he would like to participate in what she is selling. And so he goes over and he is basically asks her, "What is her price?" And she said, "Well, what are you willing to pay?" And he said, "I'll give you a kid of the flock," which was pretty sizable ordeal. It was either food or it was money that she could sell later. I know that's horrible for me to say, which was a pretty good offer, but that's for this day and time, that's exactly what it was. And she says, "Well, that's a good price. However, are you going to leave me some collateral?" That's that fancy word for pledge. It's like, so like when you go to a pawn shop and you want to give up something for money. As collateral, okay, that you're going to come and pay off your loan is essentially what is occurring here. And he says, "What do you want?" And she says, "Leave your signets and your staff and your bracelets," meaning things that were personal and of value enough that he thought she was just a harlot, but this was going to be necessary later for Tamar to reprove her father-in-law. All right, this was basically Tamar covering her own hind end for what she was about to do. Because he's about to sin, she's already sinned, and is about to sin some more as well. And he says, "Okay," and he gives it to her, and they do the act, and of course she conceives, meaning she, after this, is now with child. And she goes back home very quickly. Puts her widow garments back on and pretends to be the poor widow again. And Judah sends his buddy and says, "Hey, Hira, I ain't got time right now or whatever. We take this goat down here to the lady of the night that was off the side of the street." And he goes down there and there's no harlot to be found. And so he asks the locals and they say, "What are you talking about? We've never had a harlot here in town. There's never been one here." And so he goes back to Judah and he goes, "Well, boss, we got a problem. I can't find the lady that you slept with, and all the locals say there is no such lady in this particular area." And Judah makes a very interesting statement. He says, "Let her take it to her, lest we be shamed." He says, "Just don't worry about it. She can keep the stuff because we don't want to be shamed. We don't want to be in contempt." Basically saying that, well, we can't go find her and, take that stuff from her anyway because then we'd be doing a bad thing. It wasn't a bad thing to sleep with her. It wasn't a bad thing to pay for her time and privileges. It wasn't a bad thing to not do right by his daughter-in-law Tamar, but hey, taking back your personal items from the harlot you slept with, that's where Judah draws the line. All right, not going to do that. And it gets worse. It says, and he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." And Judah said, "Let with Shame, "Behold, I sent this kid, and thou hast not found her. And it came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judah, about the time a woman would be showing." Okay? "And it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot, and also, behold, she is with child by whoredom." So somebody comes to Judah and says, Tamar is pregnant. And the only way she could have been is if she was, you know, playing the harlot, meaning if she was sleeping around. And Judah said, "Bring her forth and let her be burnt." This is so very interesting. And again, it just proves what I was talking about, of sin breeds sin breeds sin. Judah commits this sin with Tamar, doesn't know that it's her, has his way, cannot find the woman that he did this with, goes back home. Not 3 months later, it's brought to him, his attention, that his daughter-in-law has been involved in whoredom, which, by the way, is what he just did 3 months earlier. I don't know, it's very interesting, even in our culture today, if men have multiple partners, they're kind of glorified for it. If women have multiple partners, they're called a whore, as the Bible just said here. It is whoredom, whether you're a male or a female, to sleep with multiple people. So he's already played the harlot out in public. He paid for sexual enterprises. And now it is said the same of his daughter-in-law, and he says, "Let her be burned." He says, "Bring her here. We're going to give her capital punishment for what she has done." And Tamar, of course, like I said, had already played this out in her head. It says, when she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man whose these are, am I with child." And she said, "Discern, I pray thee, whose are these, the signet and bracelets and staff?" And Judah acknowledged them and said, "She hath been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son, and he knew her again no more." Tamar is being brought forward to be burned to death for the offense of playing the whore. And she says, "Whoop, whoop, 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 whoop. Time out. Believe it or not, I know the daddy of this baby. And his stuff is right here. You tell me, Judah, who is the father?" Well, everybody and their dog would have known whose stuff this was. And Judah says she's been more righteous than I, meaning that she sought to fulfill the obligation. Now, did she do it? No, she did not do it right. She completely sinned. It was not supposed to be by her father-in-law that this obligation would be met. It was supposed to be met by the brother. So both of them did horribly wrong, but as far as who has sinned the most in this story, it has been Judah, which is why he says what he says. It says, "And it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she travailed that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound up his hand a scarlet thread, saying, This came out first. And it came to pass as he drew back in his hand that, behold, his brother came out. And she said, How hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee. Therefore his name was called Phares. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zarah." Now, here's where the beauty comes into this story, okay? And I know you're thinking, how in the world can there be any beauty? Well, the first lesson, of course, is that sin breeds sin, okay? That's always going to happen. The second lesson is that how we raise our children does greatly affect how they turn out. I know you've heard that for the last 3 or 4 weeks, but that is the main lesson that is constantly reinforced in the book of Genesis, is that what you do as a parent has consequences in the lives and the decisions that your children make. There's this ideology that, oh, well, you know, they're their own people and, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. Yeah, but guess where they learn to do what they do? From you, the parent, okay? The final lesson, though, is that no matter how much evil you commit, God can still use you because that son, Phares, is the son that is in the lineage of Jesus Christ. Even though humans and even saved people can do atrocious acts like what happens in these stories, that does not mean that God cannot use those people for his honor and his glory and his purposes. Everybody on here this morning, you may not have something nearly as wild as this story where we have the two, the horrible son who does not live up to his obligations. We have the other son, the first son, who was so horrible God just killed him. The second one was horrible at that moment of not fulfilling his obligations, and God killed him too. And then we have a father-in-law who sleeps with his daughter-in-law and doesn't even realize that he's doing so because he thinks he's just paying a harlot for her time. Okay? You may not have all of this going on in your life. However, all of us have committed sins that would make us not useful to God if we want to really get down to it. We've all committed sins that would put us in a position where God could not use us effectively. But despite all of that, God still can use us and does use us for his honor and his glory. So as you're going about your week, first of all, if you're a parent on here and you're raising your children, there are consequences for what you teach your children with your life. It's not about your words. It's not about dragging them to church. It is about who are you that they see every single day. They are not going to learn your doctrine from your mouth. They're going to learn the doctrine of your life. Secondly, sin will always result in sin until somebody does the right thing. Judah does not do the right thing in who he marries. And who he marries plays out in the lives of his children who are evil. The consequences of that evil are two of his sons die. His third one is supposed to be brought up to fulfill a certain obligation. And then he does not at all end up fulfilling that obligation because Judah decides he's not going to give his last son to Tamar. Because instead of admitting that his children were wicked and evil, he's going to try to blame Tamar for everything that has happened. And then Tamar commits the sin of deciding to play the harlot to get this job done after all, and waits for Judah, knowing that he is a horrible person and would see her on the side of the road and decide he'd like to take stop for an hour at the Tamar Inn. And while then all of that comes out into play. And Judah is going to sin again by punishing Tamar for something he had himself had just done, not just a few months earlier. Sin continues to breed sin until somebody finally does the right thing, which is Judah in this story. Judah says she's been more righteous than I. Judah admits his wrongness and does not do it again. Okay? And then finally, I know you may have some bad things in your life. You may have some sins under your belt. You may have something similar to what's happened in this story that you have done in your life. But the beautiful thing about God is that He can still always use someone if they will repent and serve. Phares ends up, even though all of this evil and atrocity has happened, even though he comes out of this extraordinarily awful situation, he is in the lineage of Jesus Christ. So that has been Genesis chapter 38. Told you guys, very, very weird story. But lots of very good points that come out of it, a lot of interesting things that teach us about the Bible, and not just teach us about the Bible, but also teach us as God's people that we need to be educating God's people about sexual things. It is high time that God's people and God's churches stop trying to pretend that that does not exist. Everybody that I know of in my church, for the most part, is a parent, which means obviously they have had to partake in this act. Do you want the world to teach them about things that are sexual? Because that right there is what the world's going to teach them. Or do you want God's people to be teaching God's people about what sex is for and why and how it is supposed to be done, and not the evil atrocities that happen here as a result of people not treating and viewing sex correctly? So lots of good things that can come out of it. I know it's kind of an odd story. I know a lot of people get uncomfortable with it, but I promise you it'll be a little bit before we bump into this topic again. So I hope everybody, though, has a great week. You guys get out of here and go study.